today by reminding you about the Surf Symposium, which is Friday. Please come if you can. You'll probably enjoy it, get some free food, and as we mentioned, a little bit of extra credit cushion. If you can't make it and you need another opportunity, email me or Naya, and we'll get back to you later. I have office hours today from 1 to 2. I may be a little bit late because of a seminar, but I'll be there. Now, I have the exams because we didn't give them out last time, and anyone who wants them can pick them up after class. This is the exams from last semester. Except for that, I think that's all I need in the way of announcements, except that you're going to need handout 1A from last time. So if you didn't pick that up, their copy, if you don't have it with you, 1B from last time, their copy is over here. Now, I have a lot of demos today. I will try and write large on the board, but all things considered, you're probably better off if you pretend the last 10 rows in this room are not there. It's up to you. If you want to sit in the back and surf, it's okay. But if you want to see the board, it's better to sit, and there's plenty of room. If anyone has any other administrative issues, please ask me after class. I'll be happy to stay. Or come to my office hours. Now, I want to pick up and talk about what we were talking about last time. We said that there were three common methods for identifying and locating proteins. And last time we talked about the biochemical methods that use variations on enzyme assays to identify proteins by their, and to locate them by their enzymatic activity. And today I want to talk about a method that's used to identify and locate proteins that have no enzymatic activity. And this is through the use of antibodies, primarily through the use of immunofluorescence. So I want to explain the immuno part first, the antibody part, and then how the fluorescent part fits in. So if you, let me just say, but the bottom line is that all higher organisms produce proteins called antibodies, usually symbolized as AB, but sometimes as IG for immunoglobulin. And these proteins vary enormously, and each one is specific for a particular target. And the target or foreign substance that the antibody combines with is called an antigen, or AG. Now, antibodies are virtually all, antibodies are all proteins. Antigens are any foreign substance. Many of them are proteins, but not all of them. And we're going to talk here not about the role of antibodies in defending your body against invasion. We'll get back to that. But antibodies as a tool. Now, antibodies are specific. Just as an enzyme has a specific shape that matches its substrate, so an antibody has a specific shape that matches its antigen. So each antibody combines with either only one antigen or a very small number of closely related ones. So this is the issue of specificity. Now, how is this possible that each antibody is specific? So now you want to look at your handout. And antibodies are often written something like this. Now, of course, antibodies are three-dimensional. But the point here is to emphasize that every antibody has a part which differs from one antibody to the next. And this is called the variable part. And this is what matches up with the antigen. So the antigen for the left one would look something like this, and the antigen for the right antibody would look something like that. So each antibody would combine only with its respective antigen, not with the other one. Now, the truth is that many antigens are big and complex. So you notice I've drawn two other pictures here under where it says antigens, next to antigen. One is something like this. A big protein or a cell might look something like that. An antibody, if there's a big antigen, doesn't combine with the whole shebang. Each antibody combines with one little piece. So our One of our antibodies would bind here, and the other antibody would bind there. So an antibody actually is specific not for a whole big protein, but for a little piece, specific piece of that protein. And maybe a protein could look like this, in which case one molecule of antibody could bind here, and one molecule of antibody could bind there. There are all kinds of possibilities. Now, remember we said an antibody has two parts. If you come back and look here, this part on the top, the grabber part that grabs the antigen, is variable. But the other part is called constant. In any species, all the antibodies of a particular class are the same. So there's another picture underneath. So this would be, say, from one species, and this from another. Now notice that both of these antibodies have the same grabber or variable part. Each would combine with the same antigen. But one is from one species and one is from another. In this particular example on this page, this one would be, say, from rabbit and this one from goat. Now, this back end, the constant part, will allow you to distinguish and to identify the antibodies. Now, there's one more feature of antibody structure we have to take into account. You notice there's a third bunch of structures written underneath. That an antibody can be drawn as this Y-shaped structure, but virtually all antibodies actually have two grabbers, not one. And that's why I've drawn it underneath like this, or like this. Now, this is important because it means a single antibody molecule can grab onto two molecules of antigen, one with each arm or grabber. And people say that the antibody is bivalent because it has these two binding sites for antigen. Now, why does that matter? If you add antibody and you want it to stick to its antigen, you want to know if they found each other. How do you know if you've made a match, antibody and antigen? The classic way of telling is that if they each grab onto each other, they form a clump. This is the basis of the original tests for blood type. If you have antibody to type B, you clump red blood cells of type B. If you have antibody against A, you clump type A's but not B's. Now, how does that work? That's that little picture on the side that says antibody-antigen complex. We're assuming that an antigen is a whole cell, it's a big thing, a whole cell or a big protein. So in that case, here is one molecule of antigen, and here is another one. These are molecules of complicated proteins or whole cells. So what's going to happen here, and I'm going to have to change the shape a little to make this work, is that one molecule of antibody, remember, has two grabbers. So one molecule of antibody can link two molecules of antigen. But the way I've drawn the antigen, the same little piece repeats more than once. And so it means another molecule of antibody could come along and link to another molecule of antigen. So each antibody grabs more than one antigen, and each antigen is connected by more than one antibody. So not only is the antibody bivalent, but the antigen also is bi or more valent. The antigen here has to be multivalent for this to work. So antibody against the B substance will clump B cells. And it makes such large clumps that they're visible to the naked eye. So the formation of clumps or precipitates was the first way of identifying the formation of an antibody-antigen complex. Now, today, people want a more sophisticated method. They don't want to have to rely on big clubs. What you want to do is, now look where it says direct immunofluorescence. If you have a little bit of antigen, and you have some antibody stuck to it, now it could have more than one molecule of antibody stuck to it. It could have another one. But you want to detect the fact that the antibody is stuck onto the antigen. So the way you do that is you have to have some sort of tag or label attached to the antibody so you can detect it. You want to add antibody, give it a chance to stick, wash off the other stuff that didn't stick, and now find where the stick stuff is. And the only way to find the stuck stuff is to have some sort of tag or label on it. Now, there are many possible labels you can use, but the most common one is fluorescence. That is, to have a fluorescent material which is attached to the back end or constant end of your antibody. Now, how do you do that? And what's a fluorescent material anyway? Fluorescent material emits light. If you irradiate with one wavelength of light, it emits light of a different wavelength. So using the proper filters, you can measure the emitted light and screen out the incident light. So what you do is shine the right light here and then detect the fluorescence from here. And people say that the antibody lights up the antigen, because the antigen becomes visible because of the attached fluorescence. Now, there are small fluorescent molecules which can be chemically attached to antibodies. So you make antibody, you purify it, and then you chemically attach a fluorescent tag. Now, how would you get antibody? You would take this antigen, inject it to an animal, and the animal would make antibody. So the example given in your very first example is this is antibody number one, and we've called it rabbit anti-mouse. The details are on the bottom of your handout for you to scrutinize when you get home. Now the idea is this antigen came from a mouse, for example. It was purified and injected into a rabbit. And the rabbit made antibody against the mouse protein. So the antibody comes from rabbit. Now what you do is you purify the antibody from the rabbit, you chemically add the fluorescent small molecule, and now you have a supply of fluorescent antibody. And now you can add the fluorescent antibody and measure how much fluorescence sticks to your sample, how much your sample lights up. And this is called direct immunofluorescence. Now, there is another kind of immunofluorescent technique which people use a lot, and that's called indirect, and that's shown in the second picture underneath. It's one more layer. So the idea is you start with the antigen, same as before, and now you have antibody directed against the antigen. So again, we have antibody. Now the difference is this time the antibody has no tag. So how am I going to find it? How am I going to detect that that antibody is there stuck to the antigen? Well, remember that for each species, the back or constant end of the antibody is always the same. So you make antibody to the back end of the antibody. If this antibody was made in a rabbit, I can now take some of this antibody and inject it into a goat. And the goat will make antibody to the first antibody. So this antibody acts as an antigen, And the goat makes antibody to it. And that antibody sticks to the back end. So this is the first antibody. But remember, it has this back here. And now we add the goat antibody, which looks like this. And this one has a tag on it. Now this is called indirect immunofluorescence. Now why on earth would anybody ever bother with this? You need two antibodies instead of one. Looks like more trouble. In many cases it's easier because, first of all, you get more amplification. For every molecule of the first antibody, I can add two molecules of the second antibody, twice as much fluorescence. So maybe I should put, as in your picture, another one here. Okay. So you get amplification. That's one way of doing it. Another reason is it's sometimes easier. It's much easier to make unlabeled antibody than labeled antibody. Now, here I've managed to identify this antigen because I had an antibody to it and a fluorescent antibody to that. Now, suppose I want to identify, I want to label, I have a protein that looks like this. And I want to add fluorescent antibody and identify it. Well, I can make unlabeled antibody to this new protein or antigen. What would it look like? It would look something like this. So by taking this purified protein and injecting it into a rabbit, I have antibody. But what's the back end of this antibody look like? If it came from a rabbit, it looks like this. Now, how am I going to find this? I already have labeled antibody that sticks to the back end of rabbit. So I can use the same labeled antibody over again to identify this complex. So each time I want to identify a new antigen, I have to make a new antibody, but I don't have to label it. I can use it and then add the label to stick to it. That's the point of indirect. Now, it mentions in your notes that there is a completely different way of using fluorescence, which I think we mentioned last semester in a couple of problems and also in class, and that is using recombinant DNA to get cells to make recombinant proteins that have part derived from fluorescent protein. And this is what Martin Chalfy, who is the chair of this department, just received the Nobel Prize for. He received 1/3 of the Nobel Prize in chemistry for the development of green fluorescent protein techniques. And there is a link in your notes to the Nobel Prize site where you can read either the citation that explains what they did, or you can read his, you can't read his speech, I think, but you can see it on video. So they have lots and lots of nice, interesting information. We've already discussed, I think, in some problems, the use of green fluorescent protein, and we will meet more. But for today, we're going to stick to this antibody business. Now, before I go on, I want to discover how this technology was used to identify and characterize the cytoskeleton. So before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions.
Are the constant portions of the antibody all the same for a given species?
Are the constant regions of an antibody all the same for a given species? Yes, for all the antibodies of the same class. You have actually 5 classes of antibody. And all of the ones of one class are the same on the back end. We'll talk about that later in more detail. Yes?
In direct immunofluorescence, when you have the rabbit produce antibodies that are tagged, how does the rabbit produce labeled antibodies?
How do you get rabbit to produce labeled antibodies? You don't. You get the rabbit to make unlabeled antibodies. You purify them, and then in a test tube, you add the label. So all the labeled antibodies in this technology have to be labeled in a test tube by chemical means. The cell doesn't make them. Okay. So now we want to come back to, why do we talk about this? Because using this technology is how people identified the cytoskeleton. People suspected that cells had a cytoskeleton, but they weren't sure. Because if you take a cell and you wash out all the soluble stuff out of the cytoplasm, and you look in the electron microscope at what's left, you see a bunch of fibers. But the question is, are those fibers the remnants of fibers that were in a living cell, or are they an artifact of what you've done to the poor cell? Now, what you would like to do is to add antibodies to the cytoskeletal material and see where the cytoskeletal material is. But if you don't know if the cytoskeleton is real, how can you isolate it and make antibody? That's the problem. So the solution came from the fact that there are structures in some cells that contain, that are permanent. People made antibody to those proteins, and they turned out to be the same proteins found in the cytoskeleton. In many cells, you have cilia and flagella. And these are made of the protein called tubulin. These are projections from the cell that move and help move the cell around. And they're made of proteins called tubulin, assembled into structures called microtubules, or MT. People knew that specialized cells had these microtubules all the time. Now, do regular, ordinary dividing cells, regular cells, have microtubules? Does your ordinary garden variety cell have microtubules? What do you think moves the chromosomes around during mitosis? Remember the spindle fibers? The spindle fibers are actually made of microtubules. They're made of tubulin. So people knew that a regular cell, no cilia, no flagella, during mitosis, it had to have microtubules. But the question is, what about interface? You couldn't see anything in interface in the light microscope. Did they have microtubules? Did they have tubulin? Who knew? So what people did was to take the tubulin from cilia and flagella, purify it, inject it to an animal, and get antibody to tubulin. And then they labeled it with fluorescence, with a fluorescent tag, and they injected it into living cells. And these antibodies, not unexpectedly, stick to the microtubules in the spindle fiber. They light up the spindle fibers during mitosis. But these antibodies also stick to microtubules that are found during interphase. The cell actually has a network of microtubules during interphase. You just couldn't see them in the light microscope. So the answer is yes, there are microtubules. And they light up from this antibody. So that says that microtubules aren't just found in specialized cells all the time. They're found in regular cells, regular eukaryotic cells, all the time. They're assembled into microtubules to the spindle fibers during mitosis, and in interphase, they're assembled into something else. What about other parts of the cytoskeleton? There is another specialized structure found only in muscle cells. And these are called thin filaments. Muscle cells contain thin and thick filaments. And the reason your muscle can move is that they slide past each other. And the thin filaments are made of a protein called actin. So what people did, and the filaments are known as microfilaments, or MF. So what people did was to take the thin filaments from muscle, purify the actin, inject it into an animal, make antibody, label it with fluorescence. So now they had fluorescent antibody to actin. If you look at regular unspecialized non-muscle cells, you can't see anything in interphase. But if you add antibody to actin to regular cells, either in interphase or in mitosis, you find structures that light up. In other words, there are microfilaments in regular cells. They're found during interphase, and in mitosis, they form a specialized structure. Now, what all of this says is that there are these two components, microfilaments and microtubules, made of actin and tubulin, respectively, and that these are found in specialized cells and in regular cells, but the structures are sort of different. So now what you want to do is take out your handout for today. You want to take out and look at 2B. Now, we're going to go over all the features here, but you really want to look at the bottom, where it says fiber, microtubule, microfilament. You notice that there it says permanent structures and temporary structures. What people have just discovered is that microfilaments form both temporary and permanent structures. So the permanent one, I want to write it the way it is on the handout, temporary permanent. The thin filaments in muscle are permanent structures made of microfilaments. Once the cell specializes and makes them, they stay there. But there are microfilaments in regular cells that change shape and assembly depending on the state of the cell. And they are called temporary or dynamic structures. Now, during interphase, these make up what is called the cytoskeleton. That is an array of fibers throughout the cell that support the cell. But during mitosis, the microfilaments actually form the cleavage furrow. Now, what that means is, if you have a big cell, and it's doubled in size, and it's going to divide in half, after the chromosomes have been pulled to the two ends, and you get to telophase, you have to divide the cell in half. And what does that is a network of actin. And the actin squeezes the middle of the cell and divides it in half. And that ring of actin forms the cleavage furrow in eggs that are dividing, or any cell that is dividing. So this ring that divides the cell in half is made out of actin. But that's only there when the cell's dividing. After the cell finishes dividing, the actin comes off and reassembles into a different set of filaments. So that's why it says cleavage furrow. Now, what about microtubules? They're found in cilia and flagella. I see that in my handout, which is on the top and which is on the bottom, is reversed. Sorry about that. That cilia and flagella are permanent structures that contain microtubules, and the spindle fibers are a temporary or dynamic structure that forms during mitosis. But then during interphase, just as the material that made up the cleavage furrow now provides some of the cytoskeletal network, the same material that made up the spindle fibers now rearranges and forms the cytoskeleton of interphase. So the bottom line here is that they took the protein from the permanent structures, used it to make antibodies to identify then the temporary or dynamic structures made of the same proteins. And from that, they identified microtubules and microfilaments. Now, there's a third component of the cytoskeleton called intermediate filaments. These were found later using different techniques, and they are intermediate in size between the other two, which is how they got their name. And I think at this point what we want to do is look at this table and see the major features of these three components. And then we'll look more carefully at the details of how the fibers form. So we've just said that the three major components of the cytoskeleton are the microtubules, the microfilaments, and the intermediate filaments. Now, each of these is made by taking a smaller single protein and then assembling those proteins into some sort of chain or fiber or cable. And the protein used to make microtubules, as we've already said, is tubulin. The protein used to make microfilaments is actin. The protein made to make intermediate filaments varies. There's more than one kind of intermediate filament. There is more than five different classes. And each class has a different kind of basic subunit. So they're all similar, but they're not exactly the same. Almost all tubulins are very, very similar. Almost all actins are very similar. But there's much more variation in intermediate fibers, subunits. So there's more than five kinds. We'll look at those kinds later today. Now, what about this tubulin, by the way, comes in two variants, which are known as alpha and beta, which are very similar to each other. But to make a microtubule, they alternate, and you need both. What is the shape of the peptide chain that is used to start? If you take a peptide chain, you stick a bunch of them together to make a tube or a filament. What does the individual peptide look like? In the case of tubulin and actin, it's globular. In the case, though, of intermediate filaments, your basic peptide is, in fact, itself a fiber. Now, we'll come back to that and see how you assemble these globular proteins to make a microtubule or a microfilament, and also how you assemble the fibers to make an intermediate filament, but we'll come back to that. Now, when you actually make the fiber or the filament, what does it look like? Now, if you turn your sheet over, there's a picture on the upper left of a microtubule and one of a microfilament. A microtubule is hollow. The two filaments are not. You can see that you take, in case of a microtubule, you take your globular proteins and you assemble them into rings. In the case of a microfilament, you take your globular proteins and you assemble it into a double long thin chain. And intermediate filaments are more complicated, and we'll come back to that. So go back to the other side now. And we have hollow versus solid, tubule versus filaments. What about size? We said intermediate filaments are intermediate. Now notice these sizes are given in nanometers. As we said last time, most cell parts are measured in nanometers. So a microtubule diameter is about 25, this is the diameter, is about 25 nanometers. Microfilaments are much smaller, 5 to 9, and intermediate filaments are in between, 8 to 12. Now, what do these proteins do? They all, as the name implies, cytoskeleton, support the cell. But the top two, microtubules and microfilaments, are involved in movement. Intermediate filaments are not. Now, in order to have movement, you have to move things, two things, relative to each other. In order to do that, you have to sort of know which is up, which is down, which is left, which is right. Microtubules and microfilaments have polarity. They have two distinguishable ends, just as this has two distinguishable ends. It has a head end and a tail end, if you want to put it that way, a male and a female, a plus and a minus, whatever you want to call it, the two ends are different. A molecule that has polarity can be used for movement because another thing can move either that way or that way, and it knows which is uptown and which is downtown. But if you have a polymer that looks like this, these are zaps, and they got a little too bent. This polymer has no distinct head or tail end. The two ends are really exactly the same. And so this kind of polymer, which is what an intermediate filament is like, is not used for movement. There's no way to tell which way you're going. And these are used for structural components, for stiffening and bracing, and not for movement. But in order to have movement, you have to move something relative to your original polymer. And in order to do that, you have to have what is called a motor molecule, which uses the energy of ATP to move relative to the firm microtubule or microfilament, to move along it relatively or to slide. You have to have another half that is able to split ATP or has ATPase activity. And the part that does the movement and splits the ATP is called a motor molecule. And intermediate filaments don't have any. There's only one type of motor molecule found for microfilaments or for actin, and that's myosin. In muscle, myosin makes up the thick filaments, which slide relative to the thin filaments of actin. How that works, we'll get to later. So the motor molecule for actin is myosin. There are two motor molecules for microtubules, which are called dynein and kinesin. They both work in similar ways, but generally one goes toward what is arbitrarily called the plus end, and one goes toward what is arbitrarily called the minus end. For these molecules, plus and minus has nothing to do with electricity, just arbitrarily one end is called the plus. And we'll go over the movement bit in a few minutes. And in fact, I think that's what I want to do next, is I want to explain how you build an actin microtubule or a microfilament or an intermediate filament. But before I do that, any questions about any of this? Now, I want to start with microfilaments because they're the easiest to understand. You remember from your picture on the other side that microfilaments are smaller and simpler than microtubules. Now, microfilaments are built of actin. Here is an actin monomer, sometimes called G-actin for globular actin. This is an actin monomer. So I can put actin monomers together to form a chain. Here I've only got two, but if I keep it up, I end up with a chain. Now remember the polymer had two chains wound around each other? So actin filaments look like this. Something like this. A thin filament or microfilament looks like this. Notice that both chains are oriented the same direction. So the so-called plus ends of both are at one end, the minus is at another. So a motor molecule can move relative to this. The molecules grow largely by addition and or they shrink by subtraction by adding monomers to the so-called plus end. So they generally grow and shrink from a single end. Now, these are, I call them microfilaments in a regular cell, temporary or dynamic. And one of the reasons for calling them dynamic is that microfilaments can get longer and shorter by addition or loss of subunits at the plus end. So there is an equilibrium in the cell between monomers of actin, or as it happens, tubulin, and the polymer. So some conditions favor the equilibrium to the left, and therefore the polymers grow and are stabilized, and you have mostly polymer. But other conditions push the equilibrium to the right, and under those conditions, your polymer, your microtubules, microfilaments would fall apart, and you would have a pile of monomers. And various conditions in the cell encourage either the growth or the shrinkage of microtubules and microfilaments. So right now we're talking about microfilaments. It turns out for both microfilaments and microtubules, we have a bunch of drugs. One of the reasons we know so much about these structures is because the drugs shift this equilibrium and either stabilize the polymer or stabilize the monomer. Most of the drugs bind to one or the other, thereby shifting the equilibrium. If you bind up the polymers, you stabilize the polymers. If you bind up the monomers, they can't associate, and you tend to have only monomers. And these drugs have both been sometimes medically useful, and they've also helped us figure out the structure and function of these proteins. So in the case of microfilaments, there is, by the way, a table. In the table on your handout, there is a little box that lists the major drugs which are involved here. There is one thing I want to check, see if I corrected it. It says in your table that cytochalasin B depolymerizes. There are actually several different cytochalasins, and I should have crossed out the B. There are several that work here. That cytochalasins are a class of drugs that bind to the monomer, stabilize the monomer, and prevent polymer formation. And phalloidin, which is the chemical in some poisonous mushrooms and does you in if you eat them, phalloidin stabilizes the polymer so that the microfilaments get stuck in that state and can't move. Now, I think that covers most of the things that are written on the table about microfilaments that are important to know. There's only one other thing on this table where it says accessory proteins. Many of microtubules and microfilaments have other proteins associated with them, which influence that equilibrium and influence other aspects of how the fibers or tubules behave. And in the case of proteins that associate with microfilaments, they're just called actin-binding proteins because actin is the main subunit. Now, by contrast, you notice there that the proteins that are associated with microtubules, which ought to be called tubulin-binding proteins, are called something else. They are called MAPs, or microtubule-associated proteins. And the only reason for telling you this is if you go and read something and you wonder, what the hell is this? Now you'll know. Now, you see how you form a microfilament by sticking the actins together, forming two parallel chains which are twisted around each other. How do you make a microtubule? Well, we said that tubulin has two variants that are very similar to each other. And they're called alpha and beta, and they form dimers. And then the dimers associate into chains, and then the chains form a tube. And this is perhaps most clearly seen on the other side of your handout, where it has the picture of a microtubule. It shows you a so-called protofilament, which is one of these, and then it shows you a bunch of them lined up to form. There are usually 13 protofilaments to form a single tubule. Now, how do these grow? They grow by adding dimers. So you would add dimers to each, and it would grow longer. Or you can take dimers off. And dimers, under most conditions, both add and subtract preferentially from the same end. In Becker, there is a whole chapter about the cytoskeleton with all kinds of little details if you find it interesting, but we are not going to go into it. And it's there largely, it's reference for your curiosity. So notice that a microtubule here also has polarity because all the protofilaments are associated in the same direction. And so it has a plus end and a minus end, and a motor molecule can tell, so to speak, whether it's going uptown or downtown. We'll explain the motor molecules in a minute. Now, how are the microtubules associated or lined up in the cell? Microtubules generally grow from a fixed point. There's usually a structure at one end, at the so-called minus end. And then, so maybe I should do it this way. There, and the microtubules start there and start growing and grow longer. So that, and the structure from which they grow is called a microtubule organizing center, or MTOC. Now there are flagella and flagella and cilia grow from microtubule organizing centers, but in a cell that does not have them, in a regular cell during interphase, what generally happens, here's the cytoplasm and the nucleus, is there's one microtubule organizing center near the nucleus, whose structure you can look up, but we're not going to go into. And so microtubules grow out from it toward the edges of the cell, something like this. So this is the microtubule organizing center. And this kind of microtubule organizing center is usually near the center of the cell, and it's called the centrosome. Now, these microtubules do not enter the nucleus. So they're going around the nucleus or behind the nucleus, but not through it. But they're forming a network throughout the cell. And remember, they have plus and minus ends. So this is the end, the plus end, and they grow by adding in this direction. Now, just as for microfilaments, there are drugs that affect this equilibrium, you have a very similar thing, monomer-polymer equilibrium for microfilaments. And there are drugs that promote growth and or stabilize the polymer, and drugs that promote falling apart or stabilize the monomer. And these drugs, the most well-known one is colchicine stabilizes the monomer, and Taxol stabilizes the polymer. Now, what is the effect of either of these drugs? If you mess up microtubules, clearly you mess up the cell shape and state during interphase. But the biggest effect is often on division. Because if you add Taxol, the microfilaments get stuck in their polymerized form and they can't move the chromosomes. And if you add colchicine, the microtubules fall apart and you can't move the chromosome. So either of these disrupts cell division. And Taxol is actually used as a drug in some cancers because it interferes with the dividing cells that are growing and forming the tumor. Now, how does movement come about from having microtubules and microfilaments? We said that you have to have a motor molecule to move relative to the microfilament or the microtubule. And if we start with microtubules and tubulin, This is the setup in an interface. This is how the microtubules are oriented. And remember we said that there are two motor molecules for microtubules, for tubulin. They are dynein and kinesin. And both of these are able to move relative to microtubules, but generally in opposite directions. In general, dynein moves things in, and kinesin moves them out. So kinesin pushes things to the plus end, and dynein pushes things to the minus end. Now, the way I remember which is that kinesin draws things toward the corners and dynein draws them in. Kinesin to the corners, dynein draws them in. Now, both of these proteins, kinesin and dynein, have certain things in common. They both have a structure which is sort of like this, so to speak, and that they have two protrusions or feet. And they actually move along the microtubule by walking foot over foot. Now, of course, they don't look like this. But they have a structure with two extensions, and they change shape as they split ATP. So first they do this, and then they do that, and then they do that. Now, what good is that? This allows the kinesin or the dynein to move relative to a microtubule. But what we want to do is move something relative to the microtubule. And the dynein or the kinesin is attached to something else. And it pulls that something else as it goes relative to the fiber, to the microtubule. So one thing that it does I just want to see which one I said first in my notes. So one thing it can do is to move another fiber relative to the first fiber. So the kinesin or dynein can be attached to a fiber itself, another microtubule, say. So now as it moves down the first microtubule, the second one slides relative to the first one. Or if it were going in the other direction, they would be sliding out. Now, during anaphase, microtubules actually slide out relative to each other. So you can push, when the sister chromatids separate, you can push one to one side of the cell and the other to the other side of the cell. The cell actually elongates, and these slide out relative to each other. Now, on the other hand, microfilaments using their motor molecule, which is myosin, slide in to form that ring or cleavage furrow in telophase. So in order for this to happen, the myosin has to slide relative, actually the actin slides relative to myosin, which is its motor molecule, which I think we wrote before. Now, dynein and kinesin both work by the sort of foot-over-foot walk method. Myosin works in a different way. Myosin only has one foot, so to speak. So what it does is to work more like a ratchet. It sort of bends over and then pushes what it had, and then it bends over and pushes the actin, and so forth. And we'll explain that in more detail later. Now, I should mention at this point a movie which is referenced in your notes. This movie was made at Harvard, and it is a Pixar quality movie of what the inside of a cell looks like. And one of the things that it shows is dynein and kinesin moving things around. And it is really a cool movie. The whole version is on the Harvard site. There is a shorter version with wonderful creepy music, which I couldn't find in a hurry last night. I found the version without the music, but I'm sure one of you with a little effort and a little Google can find the one with the movie, with the music. It used to be on YouTube, but they took it off because of copyright violations. But in both cases, if you can see all the different organelles inside the cell forming, moving, bending. And at this point, if you look at it, it's just cool. But by the end of the semester, I think you'll be able to tell what all of those things are, or at least all of them. And of course, you can always cheat and just listen to the narration. Now, one of the things that it shows is something else that Kinesin and Dynan move. And that is that they can move not just two fibers past each other, but they can move a vesicle down a fiber, down a microtubule. Now, the way this was discovered was by looking at nerve cells. We are in many ways interested in what your ordinary garden variety cell does. But sometimes the only way to figure that out is by looking at specialized cells, which are an extreme case, seeing what goes on there, and then reasoning from that. Nerve cells, or neurons, have a very special structure. Many neurons have a large cell body with a nucleus in it, and then they have long extensions. And then they end in a specialized structure which is very close to the next cell. This is called a synapse. And a message is sent from one cell to the next. But in order for this to work, chemicals and materials which are made in the cell body have to be passed all the way down this long extension called an axon to the synapse. And it also turns out that some material in the synapse has to be recovered and brought back to the cell body. So material has to travel up and down the axon, which can be very long. You have nerves, single cells, whose bodies are here in your spinal cord and whose end is in your toes. So this can be several meters long. So how do you get material down there at a reasonable rate? Diffusion wouldn't do it. It turns out there are microtubules in here, many of them. And using the right labeling procedures, you can see that vesicles are moved along the microtubules. The microtubules act almost like railroad tracks, and something is carrying the vesicle down the railroad tracks and other vesicles back up to the body. And it turns out that what is carrying them is either Dynan or Kinesin. So that what's happening here is that the motor molecule is not attached to another fiber. Instead, it's attached to a vesicle. It attaches to the vesicle, say at the cell body end, and then moves down to the synapse end and then releases the vesicle. And similarly, just as Kinesin can carry things out, Dynan can carry things back. And there are very nice pictures of that in the movie. Now, so far we've been talking entirely about microfilaments, microtubules. What's with intermediate filaments? So I want to talk about them now for a bit. Before I do that, let me ask if there are questions here. Yeah?
How fast
do they move? I have forgotten the exact number. It's listed in Becker, but it's quite fast. It's a good question. I don't remember the exact number. Maybe I'll try and look it up for next time. Yeah.
If Dynan and Kinesin travel in just one direction, how do they get back to the beginning?
That's the sort of $64,000 question. How does the Dynan get back where it came from, and how does the Kinesin get back where it came from? I don't know the exact answer to this, but I've always assumed that the Dynan carries the Kinesin or the Kinesin carries the Dynan. But I don't really know. Any more questions? Yeah.
The diagram you drew of the MTOC, uh-huh. is that going to be in both the cilia and flagella cells and the regular cells? Roughly, or is that
The question is, this: do you have an MTOC like this with specialized cells that have flagella and cilia? Yes, you have additional ones. If there's a cilium here, you'd have an additional MTOC there, a specialized one for forming the cilium or the flagella. Okay. Now, one of the reasons for talking about intermediate filaments is that the intermediate filaments are a very good example of a gene and protein family, something we didn't really have time to talk about last semester. You remember that one of the big five issues I mentioned last time is I said we're interested in function, we're interested in structure, but you're also interested in regulation and in synthesis, and we're also interested in origin. How did cells get to be able to make five different kinds of intermediate filaments? And in fact, there's more than five because each subclass has multiple kinds. How did that happen? Now, I want to discuss first the structure of intermediate filaments, and then whatever remaining time we have, we'll talk about how the family evolved. So, how do intermediate filaments form a polymer? We said that the basic subunit of an intermediate filament is itself a fibrous protein. So, this is outlined on the A side. On the bottom of your handout, we have two different pictures, two different representations from two different textbooks of how you put together the peptide chains to make an intermediate filament. And I brought these in part because I wanted to show various ways of representing a protein. Now, if you start on the bottom left, this is a picture from the fifth edition, sixth edition of Becker, which is not in the latest edition. It shows two peptide chains twisted around each other. The basic peptide chain is an extended fiber, and two of them are lined up with their amino ends on the same end and their carboxyl at the same end. And the picture from Wolf shows in parallel the same thing. But now you have a dimer, two chains, and you have another dimer, two chains. But the other dimer is oriented the other way. So if this is the amino end, this is the amino end. So they're opposite in terms of amino, amino. So that's shown in the picture. And you notice that what you have then is a tetramer of two chains pointing one way and two chains pointing the other. So I brought one more toy for that. So here we have what is meant to represent a dimer. So this is two peptide chains, both oriented the same way. This particular piece doesn't have two distinguishable ends, but we're assuming that one end is the two aminos, one is the two carboxyls. Now you have two of these, and so the two of them are, so this is a dimer, both oriented this way. This is a dimer, both oriented this way. So they come together to form a tetramer. But now that tetramer connects to another tetramer, which connects to another tetramer, which connects to another one. And you get a structure which is usually called a protofilament. And there are pictures of that, two different representations of that, in the third picture down on the left and the fourth column down on the right, D. But now these protofilaments are assembled into a cable. Now, people are actually not exactly sure what the cable looks like. That is, how this is arranged is not clear. Whether this cable is like this, one protofilament, another one, another one, another one. This, except there would be eight. There are only four in this model because this is one protofilament, one tetramer. So a real cable would have eight stripes. It's not clear whether it's flat like this, whether it's twisted. It's not clear. But notice that this is flexible. These are not ordinary Legos. Okay? And the thing is flexible. It's strong, but it's flexible and bendable. So an intermediate filament looks something like this. Exactly what its 3D shape is like, whether it's curved, as in the picture in Becker, or twisted, like the picture from Wolf, is not clear. Okay. Now, once you see something like this, you assume that this is a permanent structure. And some of these are permanent. Some of these are formed in specialized cells, which will never divide again. And once they form the cable stays. But some intermediate filaments, just like microtubules, come apart during mitosis and go back together again afterwards. Because most microfilaments are in the cytoplasm. But one class of microfilaments is in the nucleus. If you go back to your handout again, you see on the top right, it has a picture. I take it back. The picture on the bottom isn't in the current Becker. It is in the current Becker. It's this picture on the top. It's not in the current Becker. And this shows a comparison between the various classes of intermediate filament monomers. And you notice that class number 5, type 5, are called nuclear lamins. There is a kind of protein called laminin, because it's found in a structure called a lamin, called a lamina. And it is unfortunate that whoever is in charge of this business called something lamin and something else laminin. I apologize, but I wasn't responsible. So the lamins are nuclear proteins. All the other proteins of the cytoskeleton are cytoplasmic. And where these are found is, if you look in a cell, the nuclear lamins are found underneath here, underneath the nuclear membrane, and they support that membrane. Probably all membranes have something underneath to support them. And we'll come back and talk more about the details later. But that's where the nuclear lamins are. And all the other intermediate filament monomers are found in the cytoplasm. Now, we said this is a gene family, a protein family. What do we mean by that? We mean that if you take all the different kinds of lamin, if you take all the different kinds of intermediate filament monomers and you line them up relative to each other, they all have certain strong similarities. And that's shown by this picture. And one of the reasons I brought this picture is it shows you another way of representing protein structure. The pictures at the bottom show you extended chains. The picture like this is a very common way of portraying the features of a protein. They're always written in the standard setup with the amino end on the left and the carboxyl end on the right. And then people subdivide this bar into different regions or domains of the protein. Now, for example, if you look at the type 1 intermediate filament, or you look at all of them, you see there's a sort of line here, and they call this the N-terminal domain. And everything over here is the C-terminal domain. And you notice that in the different kinds of intermediate filament monomer, there are differences in the length of the N-terminal and the C-terminal domain. And in the picture from Wolf, these are symbolized as little glob, as like something like this, because this part of the protein is globular. Now, then they have here, they've drawn it like this to illustrate that it's a helical cell section. And in the picture from Wolf, that's drawn something like this to make it clear that it forms a little solid rod. Because a helical protein, the helical part forms a rod. And you notice that all of them have a helical protein here and a helical section here. And in all of them, the helical section near the carboxyl end, notice, is always about the same length. And in the first four types, the helical section on the left end, on the amino end, is about the same length. And so this part in the middle consists of helical sections that form rods, and then these sections that they've written like this, which are linkers. And you notice if you look below, the linkers are written like this, to illustrate that these sections are not in an alpha helix, but have a more random conformation. This is a place where you could have a bend in the protein or a twist. This part isn't rigid. Okay. And the numbers, these three correspond to what in Wolf's picture is linker 1, linker 1, 2, and linker 2. Now you'll see a lot of pictures like this, which illustrate the major features, domains, or sections of a protein. Now you notice that there are five types here, which can all be more or less aligned. How is a cell able to make five variants of the same protein? There are actually two ways to make multiple variants of the same protein. One is to have one gene, transcribe it, and then splice that RNA in more than one way, to use a different combination of exons and end up with a different protein. We talked about this in outline last semester. We'll talk about it in detail later. But another way to do it is to have what is called gene duplication. That in an ancestral organism, there was one copy of a gene that code for a protein like one of these. That gene, by mistakes in DNA replication, got copied or duplicated, so that in the DNA now, instead of one copy of this gene, there were two copies of the gene. And by more and more mistakes, you get more and more copies of this gene. Now, we do know that mistakes like this happen, and when you have multiple copies, over time, mutations accumulate. So the copies don't remain exactly identical. You might get a change here and a change here. And over time, these two become slightly more and more different. The longer ago the duplication occurred, usually, the more different these are within reason. But the result of this is that genes and proteins come in families. You might think if you took your cells apart that you would find 1,000 proteins, okay, 10,000 proteins, and each protein would be equally different from all the other 9,000 proteins. But it's not true. What you find is large groups of protein are similar to each other. Proteins group into families, just like dogs do, cats do, bovines do. Similarly, you have the globin family. You have a lot of globin-like chains that are all similar. You have the intermediate filament family. All of these are similar to each other. And another one that you've probably heard of is listed on here somewhere. But I think, and antibodies. There are many different kinds of classes of antibodies, as we mentioned before, and all of them are similar to each other. And all of them are thought to have arisen by a similar process, that you have duplication of the gene and then multiple copies. This is thought to be one way in which cells acquire new function. As long as there is only one copy, you can't change it very much because you might lose the original function. But now that you have two copies, you can change one and the other continues to do the old job. So selection ensures that mutations that really mess things up are lost. Mutations that in fact improve or give you a new function tend to be passed on and spread around. And so in that way, we have acquired not single genes, but groups of genes that do similar things. Now the significance of this, to wrap this up, is that each type of tissue uses a different one of the genes here in this family to make its intermediate filaments. So muscle uses one set of genes to make intermediate filaments, and skin uses a different one. And one of the advantages of this is that if you discover a tumor, you can often tell where it came from by the type of intermediate filaments which it possesses. That tells you whether it's a metastasis from somewhere else or it formed in the cell place where it is found. Also, as we'll see, mutations in these genes cause abnormal proteins, cause your cells not to have quite the right structure. For example, some blistering diseases are due to mistakes in the intermediate filament found in your skin. Now I'm going to stop here, and next time we'll talk about membranes. Now I have brought all the exams from all three classes. How many people want their exam back? That isn't that many, so just come up front and I'll go through the list and I'll find them for you.